from Shangri-La.
We are so excited to be here for a week of artist residency.
Yeah, we are doing artist residency in Shangri-La, which is in Oahu, which is in Hawaii. Sorry, we're in Hawaii. How the hell did this happen?
We are in Hawaii!
For those of you who do listen to our podcast, a few episodes ago, we were talking about the Muslim ban. Hawaii was one of the first states to push back on the Muslim ban.
Yeah!
All right, thank you. And in that episode, we said, I wish we could go to Hawaii. And look, it happened.
We put it out into the universe.
The secret works.
What a journey also to here. You've been up to a lot, Tess.
Yeah, before coming out here, I was in Atlanta for Netroots Nation. I was on a panel about messaging around Islamophobia and anti-Muslim hate crimes. And then before that, it was awesome. I was at the Smithsonian APA Lit Fest. It was super fun. I got to perform. I got to do some poems on the Japanese internment that I've been doing with Tracy Kato Kiriyama. She's a poet in L.A. So we've been in poetic conversation. So that was really beautiful. And now I'm here.
Oh, I want to be in poetic conversation.
Poetic conversations are the best.
I just got back from Sundance.
How was that?
I went to the Creative Change Retreat put together by the Opportunity Agenda. I went ziplining. That was amazing. And I bought a really expensive mattress. For somebody who is, you know, on a plane four times a month.
But now you have a great mattress to sleep on when you're home.
I have a really amazing mattress that's just like at home.
We're happy to welcome you to Los Angeles. Thanks for moving down and being closer to me.
I'm in Los Angeles.
So excited to introduce you to...
Nobody in Hawaii is cheering for Los Angeles. We don't need to cheer for Los Angeles. We don't need to cheer
for
LA.
Guys, we're in the same city now, so it'll be easier for us to record. It was really difficult to like have to schedule, so now it's going to be a lot easier. That's my hope.
And we are staying at a pool house.
Yeah.
Which is called the Playhouse.
I tweeted this earlier today. It's like we are the Cato Kaelin for Doris Duke.
I don't know how I feel about that. I'm not into that analogy, like, at all. Not at all.
So Doris Duke has many houses. Oh, we are in her estate in Hawaii, and she... This was the place where she collected Islamic art, and she's been collecting art and helping find artists to create art for 60 years.
Yeah, 60 years, yeah.
And the playhouse that we're in is just beautiful. We walked in and we were like, I can't believe we have to stay here. I don't even know how to describe it. There's like ceilings that are inspired by Morocco. There's a fireplace from Iran.
Fireplace from Iran. Yeah, the tile work around the fireplace was commissioned by an artist in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk more about that. We're going to get more into that.
Yeah, we're going to get more into it.
We have a lot to
talk about.
Cover. I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to the news. Just a couple of things going on.
There are some things happening.
And before we dive in, we do also want to acknowledge that we are on Native Hawaiian land that was colonized. We want to acknowledge that we are visitors. And thank you for having us. Thank you for hosting us here.
Thank you so much. So, first big topic. It's been beautiful to stay here, but it's been super overwhelming. Zara, what's it been like for you?
Like a mix of imposter syndrome, internal giggles, feeling like a conqueror sometimes, standing by the fence out here. It's like doesn't do it any justice to call it a fence. This gorgeous entry into the ocean, feeling like the Khaleesi. For my Game of Thrones peeps in the crowd. A couple of snaps. And then also, like, I cry randomly.
Yeah.
Like, I'm getting emotional right now. It's really hard to see all of this and then know that I can't go back to Iran.
Right, because we've been discussing about how you don't feel... Or you can't go back to Iran.
No, I can't go back to Iran. In Iran, it is illegal for a woman to be published writing about sex. And I did that. Right? And thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. Somebody give
Let's
me a
give
woo.
A cheer
All
for
right.
that.
And immediately, like, when I saw this space, which is, like, inspired by Esfahan, I got hit with so much emotion. My family's from Esfahan. So there was, like, this mix of, like, I'm so grateful to be able to see... You know, so much Iranian art. And then at the same time, it's so painful to not be there.
Yeah.
So many conflicted emotions. How about you, Tess?
I think for me, a lot of the artwork that's around is also inspired by the Mughal dynasty. And I remember I've been to India and I've been to the Taj Mahal. And the story is that Doris Duke went to the Taj Mahal for her honeymoon, which is what started this adventure in this house. And so as I walk around, I just keep having all these remembrance of going to India and to Bangladesh and visiting mosques and palaces. And I don't know, at the time when I was going on these museum tours in India, I was like, wow, what must have been like to live in these kinds of spaces back in the days? And now in this pool house, and after the museum closes, we kind of run rampant. We're not allowed to go into the museum. We haven't been doing that. But we kind of do get to walk around and run rampant with flashlights. And it's just, it is surreal because it's that feeling that I was always curious about. I was like, what would it feel like to just make something like this home for a while? Because this is how my ancestors lived, you know? Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that really, on my first day when I was, they have these beautiful white marble steps that remind me of the steps up to the Taj Mahal. And I was walking around barefoot and I was like, oh my gosh, this feels so familiar. And I was like, it was kind of just like a guttural instinct of how familiar it all felt. And it was just, I haven't been able to put to words what it feels like, but that's what I'm experiencing.
Yeah, I remember when you were walking down the marble steps barefoot, you were like, this just feels right.
Yeah.
Like home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we're home. Not leaving. Sorry, Conrad.
That's essentially what we're saying is we're going to stick around for a little while. Yeah, thank you.
Y'all can close up the museum. We'll just hide in the lava rock.
We'll just be here. I feel really comfortable just sticking around while other artists in residence swing by.
Yeah, we'll just hide in the basement.
Yeah. I am happy to host, share my bed. That's cool. I'm into it.
I bet you are.
Yeah. It's also on this day that we're recording National Kissing Day.
National Kissing Day.
What? Don't kiss me. That's weird. I was just like, so is somebody gonna like kiss me now because I said and no. Then but then now I have like FOMO.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, what if no one kisses me now?
Now it's gonna be really weird when people leave. They're like gonna be like hug, kiss on the cheek, what? It's gonna be that dance.
Oh, awkward is my jam. All right, we have some museum folks here. Museum fans. Yes.
We've been to a lot of museums while we've been here. We went to the Bishop Museum.
We went to the Pearl Harbor Memorial. The Japanese
Cultural Center of Hawaii. Yeah. And we hope to go to the Honolulu Art Museum next. It's been beautiful that's like exposure to four different museums. I think one of the things that this space is reminding us of is just how accessible is art and culture to people. I just can't get over how the feeling of like living in a museum. Do you remember that book? There's this book when you were young, when I was younger. I forgot what it was called. It was
From the Mixed Up Files.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By E.L. Konigsberg. Yeah. And basically in the book, the kids, they like hide so that they can stay in the museum overnight. That's what it feels like. But I'm bringing this up because we're talking about accessibility of art. So for me, it's like super accessible. But art and museums have such an important role when it comes to culture shifting and the politics of the time. And I think this is just a space I just never thought that artists like us would ever, you know, have access to. And like, here we are. And so I'm so excited to share this on our podcast.
Yeah, I'm also feeling this like incredible weight of like responsibility to like hold space for dialogue around Orientalism.
Yeah.
But then at the same time to like see that, be a part of that culture shifting happening. And then when I realized that like, oh, that's my work. That's what we're doing. I don't have to try to do that. That is what we're doing.
That's totally what we're doing.
By having these conversations, that is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And then I feel pretty proud. I'm going to give myself a pat on the back. Okay, so I was really excited to find out these backstories.
Yeah.
So when we first came in, so I saw the fireplace and I was like, that's Persian. Because I saw my people.
We'll take a picture of it and put it up on our website.
It'll be on our website. I was like, that looks like my dad. That looks like my brother. That looks like my cousins. And it turned out that I was right. It is Persian. And then we had a moment where we were like, oh, is this because like somebody, there was like pillaging and like some Hobby Lobby shit happened? Where like, if you guys don't know, the dude running Hobby Lobby is like literally looting via ISIS.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, we talked about this in our last episode.
So we were like, okay, wait, what is the source of this? And then we found out that actually Doris Duke had commissioned this piece, and in its time, it was like a very contemporary piece of art.
Yeah.
And actually, Leslie, the museum curator who gave me backstory on this, did a really great job of contextualizing sort of the circumstances around it. And then my takeaway was like, oh, actually, in its time, it was kind of tacky.
Yeah, kitschy.
It was kind of kitschy.
No one locally wanted to have that kind of art unless it was passed down from the family, is what you said.
Yeah, which is why it was like really rare to see Qajar art, because like usually it's like family heirlooms, like you don't really see. Yeah. And so I was like really surprised. And then I found out, oh, it's because nobody else wanted it.
Yeah. And then that totally like twisted my mind, because I was like, well, then what is Orientalism then anyways? Because if she's preserving art that no one wanted, then
well, and also commissioning it,
and commissioning it. Yeah, I just got all confused.
And so we decided that
it's okay.
Yeah,
I feel like it's okay.
We've decided that it's cool to be a white savior.
No, we didn't decide that.
Oh, that wasn't our takeaway.
That was not the takeaway. That was not the takeaway.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Got it.
Speaking of white saviors, there's a lot of Nazis out and about. How's that segue?
What the fuck? I am tweeting about Nazis and it's not a metaphor?
Yeah, not a metaphor.
What the fuck?
Since our last show, Charlottesville happened.
In case you weren't sure what you can get away with as a white man, as a cisgendered white male in this country right now, clearly there's a lot that you can get away with.
My favorite part is that after the Nazis showed up to the Nazi rally, they were like, no, we're not Nazis. That wasn't us in the photo. That was me in the photo, but I just really liked Confederate statues. You know, like everyone like pulling back from the word Nazi. They're like, I'm just alt-right. I'm not Nazi. It's the same thing. Nazi, alt-right, same.
And 45 is tweeting.
Yeah. 45's response to Charlottesville was just horrendous. I think it took him a few days to respond, and it was super basic. And then he responded with, not everyone was bad, like 4 days after that. And then even after that, it just his response kept getting worse and worse and worse. And it's just, I think what was so irritating for me was that, like, there was all these white folks who before were like, oh, it's, you know, it's not that bad. And they were like, oh, my God, did you know Trump was a racist? And everyone, people of color, was like, yeah, we told you. We told you this before the elections. We told you this way long ago. You know, everything. And then I think there was something about the media representation of having white faces in the media where white folks all of a sudden started paying attention, which right. I felt I was really hurt by that. Mm. I'm really shocked by that. But then at the same time, I was like, well, fine, like, whatever. Like, as long as people are paying attention that he's a racist, fine, great, awesome, that's happening. But just the fact that it took not black faces getting killed, but it took white Nazis holding tiki torches, you know, for people to get upset, then fine.
And beating people.
Yeah.
And it felt
killing
like
people with cars.
It felt like the beta test for a lynch mob.
Yeah, which it was in many ways.
It felt like they were trying to see, you know, how far can we take this and how far can we twist this and how much can we normalize this? What can we get away with? And it's freaking me out.
Yeah. And then Bannon was like let go from staff like 2 weeks before the event had happened, but they didn't announce it until like a week after the event happened. And then he went straight to be the chief editor at Breitbart. It was just like the Nazi shuffle happening right now.
Ugh. This is semi-tangential, but the way the media coverage of this gets handled a lot of times feels like it just feeds into the like reality show formula. And it is just like so gaslighting constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see, in addition to that, him taking each opportunity, 45 taking each opportunity to manufacture a new narrative,
mm-hmm.
like galvanizing a false anti-Muslim mythology that it is effective in combating terrorism to dip bullets in pig's blood.
Which is something that's been said for a while, right, by the alt-right. They've been using this for a while. They sell them on anti-jihadi websites, these bullets covered in pork. But, you know, this is our president that's talking about this. I'll read his tweet. His tweet said, study what General Pershing of the United States did to terrorists when caught. There was no more radical Islamic terror for 35 years. And this was done just hours after the Barcelona incident had happened. Mind you, Charlottesville, it took him many, many days to respond. And he said he couldn't respond sooner because he needed to get all the facts. But yet, for something like this, he was able to respond within an hour. This is a fallacy that's being perpetuated by the alt-right about General Pershing, who went into, I believe, the Philippines and allegedly used bullets covered in pig.
Which he did not.
Which he did not. And they say that's why they won and that's why it hasn't happened. But it's all fallacies, right?
It's based on, he's making an argument based on a lie.
Yeah.
Which is like to unravel that and to keep up with everything else is nearly impossible.
Right. And he's using that lie to uphold his power and to uphold the Nazis that are out there.
And meanwhile.
And then I took a stress nap after I read that, because I was like, I can't deal. This is too much.
In addition to that, this is him saying that while people are selling ISIS hunting licenses.
Yeah.
Which really shook us also, because we had gone to Manzanar and we just got back from Honolulu, and the parallels are terrifying.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize the extent of the parallels.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm in LA, and everyone who listens to the podcast knows I do a lot of work with the local Japanese American community there. And now we're in Hawaii, and Hawaii has a huge Japanese American population. But, you know, we didn't realize this until we went to the museum, that it was kind of like the 1965 Immigration Act. It was an intentional going into Japan, trying to get laborers to come to Hawaii to work in the fields. And that's kind of how a lot of South Asian migration happened too. Indians from South Asia went to go work in the fields of the sugar canes of Fiji and in the Caribbeans too. And I keep thinking about 1965, because 1965 Immigration Act, which helped bring Asian Americans over on electrical engineering, medical schooling and stuff, that's what brought our parents over, our dads.
Yeah.
And I keep thinking about that parallel existing. And then the other thing that I was thinking about was just what we saw in Manzanar happen was that in Manzanar and all the camps on the continental U.S., all 10 of the camps, they were just kind of like locking up everyone. But here the population was so huge, it was 40%, that it was a lot easier for them to lock up the leaders and the people who they thought were influential.
And what we saw also was that it was even more specifically economical.
Right, because they owned businesses, and it would be really disruptive to their economy if they did lock up everyone. So they said, we're only going to lock up folks who were influential. And just like, yeah, it was really interesting, because it was really easy for us to imagine, okay, how could this play out as a Muslim American? Well, are they going to lock all of us up? Are they going to lock some of us up? And how does this translate into modern tactics?
Yeah, that just makes me nauseous. We visited the internment camp at Honolulu.
We visited.
With the team at Shangri-La.
Thank you for
taking us and making it possible. It's not open to the public yet.
Yeah, so we left Shangri-La and we drove into the island. We drove to a part of the island which was really deserty. And I didn't expect that, because I thought everything was going to be tropical on this side. And I was commenting about, oh, this is so hot. The dirt is all red clay. And I can't imagine anyone, you know, really living here. And of course, that's where we turned for the camp. And I was like, of course, because that's what happened in Manzanar. Manzanar is in a really isolated, deserty place, too. And then we parked, and then we had armed security guard us, which was really interesting. Security from the National Parks Service. And we had an awesome tour guide, the one staff member from the National Park Service, Becky.
Can we get a round of applause for the National Park Service, by the way?
And
another government program also in danger that needs our support.
It is now a federal camp, and they're trying to renovate it and make it accessible to people, but it's not open to the public. They gifted us this opportunity, where we felt so blessed to have this opportunity. And she said that it was because she realizes the importance of the site, and she really wanted to connect with folks outside of the Japanese American community like us. And I was like, wow, that's like as activist as you can get from the inside.
Yeah.
Of the National Park Service. There's a few takeaways that I have from the experience. So when we walked down the disgusting gulch, and I just couldn't imagine people living there. It was all kind of run over with long grass, and the grass had been planted because after the camp was done, the camp existed for 3 years. After the camp was done, they turned it into a ranch, and it was
for cattle.
And it was just kind of run over with invasive grass.
That stuck with me too, because at Manzanar, a lot of the fencing was actually used by cattle ranchers.
Yeah. And when we got to the bottom, all that was left is the foundations. There was nothing really preserved.
The foundation to the mess hall.
And then everything else was kind of grown over. And this was also similar to what we learned about Manzanar, because in Manzanar in the 1970s, when the local LA Asian American activists wanted to go see this site, it was because they were connecting it to the local civil rights movement, and they were connecting it to the African American activism that was happening, and they were like, nothing exists for us, so let's try to like turn this into something. And that's kind of what's happening here now, is that this space exists and the activists are getting together and they're saying like, this is something that we have to remember. And hopefully, Becky said, hopefully in 10 years they're going to turn into something.
Yeah, it'll be a site.
It'll be a long-term project. I had like 4 points that I took away from here. One of them is that Japanese immigrants had been brought here to work in the fields initially. They were working in the sugarcane fields and they were digging the aqueducts and drains. And that's a lot of where they existed around this space. And I thought it was, I mean, ironic's not the right word for it, but it was just
painful
that they were digging the water source that they ended up having to live in.
Mm. For me, the takeaways, I mean, aside from what you so eloquently mentioned, is also the length of time that it took. I think a lot of people, when they think of internment, think of it as a thing that's overnight. But in all of these cases, it was strategic. It spanned 8 years. It was not overnight. And there are measures that we have in place already in terms of surveillance that is the first step that brought the internment list into play during Japanese internment. So for me, that is the part that starts to get really frightening. And then I get very angry that we're talking so much about this boogeyman and less about infrastructure. Mm-hmm. This is so random. But I'm just like sitting in my body, all I care about right now is government infrastructure programs. That's it. Like nothing gets me hotter right now. And the collapsing of them, the dismantling of them, the turning all of our government programs and all of our funding into police forces, law enforcement forces, ICE expansion, as opposed to the general welfare of people, post offices, national parks, national monuments. Like it just is really terrifying. And I guess I just want to impress the point that I don't want to throw in like a call to action, but it's kind of a call to action. Like, let's not let the boogeyman have all of the attention that he wants.
Yeah.
And speaking of winning, we have next one of our favorite segments.
Creeping Sharia.
Zara, what's your creeping Sharia?
Okay. So, you guys, we're all a fan of Hawaiian shirts, right?
How many people in here are wearing Hawaiian shirts right
boom,
now?
Boom, boom, boom.
Y'all are creeping Sharia.
All right. The Aloha shirt, also known as the Hawaiian shirt, made its way to the mainland USA during pre-statehood Hawaii, thanks to the pioneering textile manufacturer and Syrian American Alfred Shaheen. In fact, and I'm quoting his website directly here, in recognition of his contributions to the state of Hawaii in July of 2001, Alfred Shaheen was presented with Hawaii's Lifetime Achievement Award. Yeah, give it up.
Oh my gosh. Do you know how many right-wing old white dudes wear Aloha shirts and they're probably creeping Sharia and they didn't know it?
Also, I'm a fan of postulates. As a Muslim, I'm really into geometry. We invented that. Elvis wore a Hawaiian shirt on his album cover. Elvis is Muslim.
Elvis is Muslim.
That is my creeping Sharia. What you got, Taz?
My creeping Sharia is that you and I are staying indoors Duke's pool house. And that's the ultimate creeping Sharia in my eyes. In addition to that, one of the projects that I worked on while we were here was a mixtape. I was asked to make a mixtape for the museum, so I finished it. It's going to be posted up. One of the projects that I have is a site called Mishti Music, where I curate South Asian American music. The album is called Oriental Fantasy, the Shangri-La mixtape. It will be available on Shangri-La's website, and it will be available on Mishti Music's website, so mishtimusic.com. So check it out. There's 35 musicians on there. I feature a lot of South Asian American music, but I also have some exotica in there. I'm a big fan of exotica genre, Martin Denny type, Les Baxter. And then there's this story of how this Hawaiian slide guitarist went to Kolkata, Tao Mayo, and he taught a local Kolkata Indian musicians how to do the Hawaiian slide guitar. So there's a lot of music out there that incorporates Hawaiian slide guitar that's on classical Indian music. So there's some of that stuff on there too. I know. You didn't know this about this place. There's some thing going on.
Where can our listeners access this fantastic mixtape?
MishtyMusic.com.
All right. It's fatwa time. I just wanted us to just, like, on three, just go, fatwa. 1, 2, 3.
Fatwa.
Oh, that's badass. What's your fatwa, Tess?
The eclipse. The eclipse just happened. I couldn't really see it because we're in Hawaii, and Hawaii didn't get a lot of coverage on the sun. Apparently, it went through the middle of the continental U.S., but it made everyone kind of weird, you know? So, and then I read some articles about how eclipses make everyone a little off because the gravity's off. But one of the things that I learned is that in Islam, you're supposed to do a special prayer when it comes to eclipses. And that eclipses are a sign of miracle, basically, from Allah. And
so are you fatwaing miracles?
I'm not fatwaing the miracle aspect. That would be bad. Just fatwaing the weird feeling that comes after eclipses.
Interesting. This weird feeling you're talking about, I was feeling it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I found out that mine was because of a spider bite. That turned into an infection.
I told you I had to fatwa spiders.
I fatwa spiders.
This was our maybe like third fatwa in our podcast.
On behalf of all spiders, I'm going to take this as their recourse. I'm reinstituting my fatwa on spiders.
Did you get bit on the plane or before the plane or after we landed in Hawaii?
Okay, so I went to the doctor to figure this out.
Yeah.
Right? Because I couldn't tell, like, was it after the plane ride? Was it on it? Was it, and of course not on the plane. It was on the plane ride, you guys. When I saw the doctor at urgent care, like, first of all, this doctor is like 7 feet tall, which like I noticed because I'm a tall person. Mm-hmm. I'm like 5'9", and I was looking up, and he was like built like a linebacker and super tan and really hot. And he talked like this, and he was like, "Hey, so what have you got? Oh, that's redder than I'd like. Do you want some antibiotics?"
Why is he asking you? Like, he's the doctor. He should be telling you, you should take some antibiotics.
So I took the antibiotics. It got worse. I went back. I saw another doctor, and she drew a marker line around it and was like, you know, okay, so we want to, like, keep track of this, and it's, like, swelling. And in case this ever happens to you guys, whenever you have any kind of, like, wound or bite or something like that, on a plane, the pressure, it makes it worse. So that's what happened. Yeah, see? There. So she drew a line around it to sort of like mark the swelling and see if it gets worse. And she said, you know, it's an aggressive infection. And so we need to treat it aggressively. So I'm going to give you a shot. And tomorrow, if it's not significantly better, then come back in for a follow-up shot. Then, of course, I came back and it was original doctor, Mr. Hotlinebacker. And he saw my arm and he goes, "Oh, somebody drew marker on you." And I said, "Yeah, it was a doctor." And then he said, "You saw a different doctor than me?" And I said, "Yeah, yesterday I went into the facility. It was a different doctor. She drew a marker. She said that I should probably get a follow-up shot." And he said, "Is that what you want to do?" And I said, "I think so."
And he said, like, "You're the doctor?"
I kind of was just like, "You're really hot." "You're really hot and you're really tall and I'm cool with this. And I kind of want to tell you about other ailments I might have."
Was he the one that gave you the shot?
Girl, shots? No.
Oh, Zara no. Got shot, two shots on her butt.
I got two shots on my butt and neither of them were by a hot doctor. So anyway, that's my fatwa on spiders.
Thank you so much to the Shangri-La team for taking Zara to the hospital.
Oh, yes. I do need to give a huge shout out. Thank you to Noor, Leslie, Paige, Billy, all of you, Conrad, all of you guys checking up on me and with the eclipse, checking in to see how's Zara doing. Is it an eclipse thing? Is it a spider infection thing? They've been checking up on me and driving me to urgent care. And so thank
like
you guys.
Every day.
Yeah, yeah. Literally every day.
Awkward ask a Muslim. I thought I would have more by now. I was thinking that I probably have more and that I just haven't been remembering. Because whenever I travel, that's when I have a lot of awkward ask a Muslims.
It's probably the eclipse made you forget.
The one awkward ask a Muslim that I do remember is I got asked to be interviewed in The Atlantic, and I love The Atlantic, so I will jump at every opportunity to do an interview.
Oh, you got
them.
Fans, Atlantic fans in here.
Yeah, the magazine. They're like, can you talk to us about millennial Muslims getting married? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm totally a millennial Muslim getting married, which I'm not.
In case you weren't clear, Taz is single. I'm
also not millennial. Taz is single. But I was like, sure, I'll do this interview. And it was like an hour-long conversation about how all these younger Muslims are getting married and how they're getting married. And at the end of it, I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Why did I agree to do this interview? Because it gets depressing talking about being single. And then I talked about joining a Muslim dating site because I read about it in the Washington Post. And it's called Muslim Match. And the selection there is not very good. It's called Muzmatch. I ended up talking about plastic grapes with one of the guys, and I was just
what?
Like, I don't understand this conversation. Is this how Muslim men who want to get married flirt? Maybe this is why I'm single? I don't know, man.
It's, why
the picking
plastic
wasn't good.
Grapes?
I don't understand either. And then
Did he bring it up?
He brought it up. I tried to continue the conversation. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember plastic grapes from when I was younger. What kind of grapes were they, green or red? And then he was like, I really liked your message. Do you want to meet up with my friends? And I was like, I don't understand this conversation at all. This is not... Then I wanted to quit dating again, which is basically what happened.
I'm going to stay married.
What's your awkward asking Muslim?
Plastic grapes? There's got to be some kind of rando Reddit post that's like, dude, you guys, if you post about plastic grapes, it's like a great way to like, set yourself apart from the other dudes. She'll remember you. But I guess it worked.
I remembered. That's true.
All right. My awkward ask, I remembered because we were here. We were going around the tour. And I was thinking back to this time that I was at the British Museum where the woman curating it was talking. She was just like talking shit about Greeks the whole time. And she like kept looking at me. And she like went through like... exhibit after exhibit, like talking about how like the Greeks didn't know what they were doing and like they had to like take the like marble, yeah, because they were like chipping it off and selling it, and if it wasn't for the good graces of the British Empire stepping in to rescue this gorgeous marble, and she just like kept looking at me, and then she comes up to me and she's like, oh my God, my dear, are you Greek? And
I said, a good accent.
Oh, thank you. And I said, no, I'm Iranian. And then she goes, oh, aren't you glad you're not there?
Ooh.
I know. And then she didn't even wait for a reply. She just like moved on and was like, so back to talking shit about the Greeks. And I was just like, what? Do I call?
Awkward.
I feel like, yeah, this is super awkward. I feel like I should commandeer this exhibit right now.
She could find her. Be like, we're in the museum.
All right, it's time for Good Muslim Awards. What you got, Taz?
I'm giving my Good Muslim Award to Dean Obidallah because...
Oh, a comedian.
He is a comedian. We got to meet him for the Muslim Funny Fest
yes.
in New York.
Comedian, commentator. You can catch him on Sirius.
He is suing the Daily Stormer for... Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's actually pretty frightening that... the Daily Stormer was accusing him of being the mastermind behind the Manchester bombing that had happened. For folks that don't know, the Daily Stormer was also hosted on GoDaddy, and then they got booted off of GoDaddy, and then they went to Google, and then they got it booted off of Google, and then they went to now some 20-year-old Asian American youth is hosting the site because he wanted free expression. This is a totally a side tangent, but we need to have a conversation about Asian Americans that think they're white. This is a big part of my day job that I do, and I'm trying to push back on it with 18 million rising.
Then I'd have to jump in with all the Persians who say they're white.
Yeah. We need to have a conversation about people who are holding up neo-Nazis, who are people of color. That was tangential. But Dean is suing, and I think it's just really brave of him to be suing. It was brave of him to be the victim of all of this. I can't imagine the kind of hate he was experiencing.
Yeah, to survive it.
And now to fight back against that.
Dude, he's suing Nazis.
He's suing Nazis. He's suing... it's a good Muslim award to him. Best of luck on that. I remember when I told you about this, Zara, you were just like shocked. You're like, oh, this comedy's so hard.
I sent you a gif of Forrest Gump running.
Yeah. I mean, Dean is a comedian. He's a political comedian, but he's an artist. He's a comedian. He's not, you know, he's not running around with guns, you know, like he's just like us. And it's so easy in this day and age for comedians are on the front line of what we're fighting right now. And it's so easy that for this to happen. And good Muslim award to him. We'll be keeping an eye on this one.
We've got your back, Dean. My good Muslim award is to Farideh Farhi. Oh, some people know her in the crowd. She is a curator at the museum. She's phenomenal. She gave me a tour today. I'm giving her a good Muslim award because I have never seen such a complex, nuanced scaffold in curation. It was like nothing I've ever seen. And she did it just like effortlessly. You know, and like, and welcomed me in and told me like, when is a good time to bounce? Cause like I had to leave early and I was like really trying to get in time with her. And cause I'd heard about how incredible she is. For those of you who need me to Vikingize her name, Farideh Farhi, I always have to do that. My name is like Zahra, right? Zahra. But then like the American Vikingization of names then is Zara. Yeah. So Farideh, however you say it, look for her at the museum, and really anybody curating at Shangri-La, holding space for politically savvy conversation about Islamic art.
Yeah, I've been really impressed by how the conversation here is trying to tie and redefine what is contemporary when it comes to Islamic art and who is at the forefront of that. And it's been really interesting to participate in those conversations. So I've been really impressed while I've been here.
She broke down art by centuries,
yeah,
by battles, by cultural trends, by trends in the arts that I didn't even know. She made connections with the Ummah that I was impressed to see within the first 10 minutes of a tour. It was just phenomenal. So yeah, good Muslim award.
Maybe we should give a good Muslim award to our audience. We're at the end of our show. Thank you so much to our audience here in Hawaii for coming out. And thank you to Shangri-La. We're so excited to be here. I'm still so excited. We were excited about recording this podcast. Still excited, even though it's at the end of the podcast.
And really excited that we won't be leaving and we'll be hosting other artists in residence in their stay.
Zara, what you got going for you in the next month? I can't even think. Like, you can ask me anything. I'm just like, in Hawaii.
that's kind of how I'm feeling, too.
What you got this month?
Oh, good Muslim award also to the ocean for being very good during the recording. And to the birds that were very chill. Yeah, there's the ocean, if you guys can hear it in the background. Up next, I will be in the Bay doing comedy and in Los Angeles. Check it out, ZaraComedy.com. Tomorrow night, I will be performing at Mark's Garage. Come out. Join me there. Yeah, please.
And I have a new website. So if you want events, you can visit tazzystar.me, and I'll have some information there.
Oh, your new website is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. Before we close out the show, Zara, I got laid 3 times on this trip.
Ow, 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 ow.
How many did you get?
I got laid 3 times.
Yeah,
3 times.
Not with each other. We have beautiful lays on. They smell very good.
And 2 shots in my butt cheeks.
Until next time.
Happy National Kissing Day, everyone. Thank you, Shangri-La, for having us!
Thanks for listening to the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast, hosted by Taz Ahmed and Zara Norbash. You can follow Taz on Twitter at TazzyStar, that's TAZZYSTAR, and Zara at Zara Comedy, that's ZAHRA Comedy. The show is produced and edited by Quincy Sarasmith, and you can find us on the web at goodmuslimbadmuslim.com. To follow the conversation, please use the hashtag GoodMuslimBadMuslim. Good Muslim Bad Muslim is a proud member of Potluck, a collective that features stories and voices from the Asian American community. Holy Potluck.
case you weren't clear, Taz is single.
Taz is single.
Taz is single.